is our home stretch. We will end at 4:30, so we have a lot to cover, and it's okay if we don't get it all done. That will mean we'll continue on in our studies. So we went through the handout and we looked at Urs, Dhamma, Citta, and then the 52 mental factors. And then on that, right below the mental factors, there's material phenomena. So we have those four elements, 1 through 4, that were the basis. And then if you can expand those in different ways to get different aspects of material phenomena. And presumably for each mental moment, there's a, it's not really depicted here on these diagrams that they're doing, but kind of as the, I think I said earlier, the organ and the object were formed. So they're a combination of at least the four elements and then certain aspects of the other, the 24 different material factors that form the basis. So for each mind moment, there has to be a some form of material phenomenon. Even when we get into these states, these formless sphere of consciousness, that without, at least from a Buddhist perspective, if there's no body, there's no mind. And if there's no mind, there's no body. So it's kind of, you can get into certain ethical or certain, I don't know, philosophical considerations of, you know, people who are in comas, you know. Actually, what happens is if the brain is damaged to a greater degree, the body begins to progressively shut down. So people who are, you might have heard the term brain dead, they can be maintained on life support for only a certain while, and then not all of the mechanisms are known. Certain organ systems are shut down, and most of the people who are in these long-term comas still have some functioning of the mind there, even though they may be, you know, they may not feel pain, they may be completely what we call unconscious. If their heart and lungs and the organs are still functioning, there's some element of the mind left, but if the mind has been completely damaged, either by a stroke or common phenomenon is people will suffocate, you know, they'll either not get enough oxygen to the brain for whatever reason, and overdose is a common example these days, or drowning or something like that, where the body will survive that traumatic event and the brain will be damaged to such a great extent that, you know, in due course, usually in a matter of a few days, the body will completely shut down. And, you know, so the Buddhist model is one of their dependence on each other, the mind and the body. So I'm not going to go much into the material phenomena. I just wanted to... now, this is... So if we go to our handout still, consciousness number one, the greed rooted with mental pleasure with wrong view unprompted, which is here, it's listed at the top of the corner, it's mundane versus the super mundane. It's in the sensitive fear phase, it's unwholesome, it's rooted in greed, accompanied by joy. Here they say pleasure, mental pleasure, but it's joy. Associated with wrong view and unprompted, these are the different mental factors that constitute that. So we have our universals, 1 through 7, here. These are the ethically variable. So in every single mind moment, you will have these 7. And you will have some combination of these 6, what's called the occasionals here, the ethically variable occasionals, might be better. Decision, sustained application. Sorry. Initial application, sustained decision, energy, ichi, and desire. So those are the ethically variable. And then what's next? We have these unwholesome factors. So in every unwholesome mind state where this is unwholesome, we have these four universals. There's always going to be delusion. There's shamelessness, the fearlessness, and the restlessness. Those will always be there. And in this particular mind state, we have greed, and we also have wrong view. So those are from that list on the right of occasional unwholesome factors. So this shows us what the different mental factors go into making up each mind moment. And so from the Abhidharma, they went through and looked at all of these 89 different forms of consciousness, mind moments, and broke them down into these different... And then what's not shown here again is what the material matter, you know, you could put a foundation here of what, these are just mental factors, right? We have material factors involved in there too. So you can see this kind of, you know, massive array of possible mind states in the different moment. I always like to put this up. This is from the Middle Length Discourse, this is Sutta number 19. And we know this, right? If we really fester about something, we kind of get stuck in that rut. So this really speaks to how important cultivation of the mind, practicing meditation, and how it really reshapes the mind. Okay. I think we'll jump into our next topic here and then have some time at the end. Now it gets really interesting. So, in the suttas, we hear over and over again about Paticca-samuppada, which is sometimes you'll hear translated as dependent origination, dependent co-arising. Different ways that this can be translated, but basically what this is describing is in a very, again, minute detail of how we suffer, how do we create this dukkha. And you'll recognize some of the factors here. We have our five aggregates again. The second noble truth is that craving is the cause of dukkha. And by the way, dukkha on this chart is sometimes substituted here. This is aging and death, but sometimes dukkha will be there. So basically this is drawn as a wheel here, and it's just a graphic. It's really, this is not a linear progression, but for simplicity it is here. So it starts with ignorance, right? And I think Lori pointed out that... number 14, a universal and wholesome is delusion. It's the same as ignorance here. And from that come mental formations that are based on ignorance, and then consciousness that's based on that ignorance. It gives rise to mind and body. So this is just a very simple division between mind and body. And more specifically, the six senses that we've been talking about. There's a contact that occurs with the sense spaces from that. Feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral arises. What we do in that next moment is we crave. We have this craving that develops. A stronger form of craving is called clinging. So maybe craving would be wanting something, and clinging would be really wanting it. You know, it's kind of the commentary of texts talk about craving is a thief that's going through a house looking at things, and let's say there's a wallet or something, a nice object, and craving is the hand reaching out, and clinging is actually grabbing onto it. When we're here, we're really stuck on it, we're really attached to it. When that happens, we have what's called becoming, which leads to birth. And so one way of looking at this, and some people say this is metaphorical. One way to look at it is when we are clinging or really attached to something, what do we become? You know, we create this identity. You know, for example, if I really wanted to steal this, what's happening in my mind is I'm creating this identity of this is going to be mine. I'm going to possess this. And sometimes we actually can have this kind of proliferation of fantasy about, you know, what's this going to be like when I get it. It's interesting when they look at the functional MRI scans of people craving this whole addictive cycle of where the activity is the strongest in the mind when, you know, this whole movement towards wanting something and getting it. Where would you imagine in the whole cycle of, you know, thinking about something, wanting it, reaching for it, and actually getting it and having it? Where do you think the strongest sensation in the mind, the activity? Yeah, the reaching of it, not getting it, not possessing it, not initially thinking about it, but the actual, that moment before when you, maybe when the mind knows it's going to get it, or at least thinks, oh, this is a done deal, that's where the highest, and it's in the reward system of the mind, the dopaminergic neurotransmitters has the biggest spike right before we get our desired object.
You're becoming related to you're talking about the seat.
Yeah, that's a specific form of it. Yeah, so basically it can also be, sometimes it's called identification of it. So becoming is, you know, creating a self around that that clinging. And we've been talking here about this term craving and clinging. We think about desire and wanting and all that, but it can also be the reverse of mind state. So craving is not wanting something, and clinging in that case would be really not wanting. So what happens from our contacts, our six senses, we see the goal, is that contact, the feeling is pleasant, I want the goal, I really want it, and then, you know, the birth of me who wants it. There could be seeing, you know, unpleasant, something unpleasant, you know, maybe you don't like the goal, you have that contact, so there's an unpleasant feeling here, leads to not wanting an aversion, you know, an actual, you know, kind of a negative aversion state. They're both unwholesome. The wanting and the not wanting and the really attachment to it. But I just want to kind of clarify the terminology here, because we think of craving and clinging in terms of desirous states, but they can also be aversive states. So once that identity is created, there's this birth of the identity. There's nowhere to go but for that to die, right? All things are impermanent. So if I get the object, that I'm not going to the rest of my life just kind of hold it and go, my precious, I'm going to get bored with it, right? It's going to break, you know, I'm going to move on. Someone else will steal it from me. So I get arrested, I go to jail. I mean, you know, not good things are happening in this cycle. So
sounds like it's causing suffering.
Yeah, well, yes, this, the cause of suffering, right, is craving from ignorance. And this is the relational formulation that the Buddha taught of how that happens. This is all throughout the suttas, you know, the Buddha teaching this. And then in the commentaries, this was really developed into multiple lives to deal, you know, to integrate karma, so that I think the way it is in one life, you have ignorance and formations, and then that is born into another life, the consciousness is born into another life, which comprises these factors, and in the third life is the birth, becoming and birth, which results in death. So that's an example of how what passages were in the sutta were then kind of chewed up and digested and amplified. And, you know, now within the Theravada lineage, if you read the Suttimagga, this is how the dependent origination is described in terms of three life model. And, you know, that's really hard for a lot of us Westerners to, first of all, to understand, but second of all, to really believe in and get behind. You know, the way a lot of teachers teach it is this is what happens in you know, a split second. You know, we out of ignorance, our mind does all of this. This is not a, this is maybe metaphorical birth, aging and death. And again, this, the aging and death is where we suffer, you know, where the coveted item is no longer mine, I lose it, I lose interest in it, and that's that unsatisfactoriness.
And Jeff, that actually can happen in mind moments. So this is something that gets created and it conditions the next mind moment. So that's why there's this cycle, because we go back to the earth ignorance again. So that thing, whatever it is, has passed, and we go to the next thing that we then see or hear or whatever it is, and then we cling to that, and we become something else in that process.
Yeah, exactly. It conditions the next moment, and
so each time the cycle is broken, it becomes more likely that the cycle will be broken for good. I mean, you're breaking a cycle. Each time you are aware and say that comes up in the feeling or the craving, you're aware and you say, for instance, I don't have to act in this moment on that craving or that clinging or whatever. And so you don't. So that sets up the next moment for recognizing, hey, I didn't have to act last time, I don't have to act this time. Especially if habituated, like addictions and that sort of thing. So, and I would think that.
So that leads to something called transcendent dependent origination.
Yeah, I don't even think we have to go to that quite yet. But yeah, I would say that's true, that the more likely we're able to recognize on whatever level what's happening here. And they say that the link that is the most susceptible to breaking the cycle, you know, here I call it the cycle of reactivity, this is all reactivity driven, this link here. So if we can, through meditation, really start to see our feelings, you know, the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And I'm not talking about emotional feelings, but, you know, that very basic aspect of experience. And see how that, you know, kind of very rapidly escalates to craving. Then we have a chance, you know, and the way we do that is by seeing our patterns over and over again, like you said, and then eventually, you know, having some foothold, some skills through, you know, cultivation of the mind. Meditation to not go there, and then it gets easier. You know, once we stop, once we break an addictive cycle, I think we all know this. I mean, we're certainly susceptible still, but we have, you know, the skills and the neural pathways to do it differently. There's another graphic. Yeah, this is kind of a general application of dependent origination. You know, then this just says that things cause other things to happen and things cause other things not to happen. So when something is conditioned by another object, if you take away the conditioning object, it doesn't happen anymore. And again, these are events, right? It's not little things, it's processes. Okay, and here's just another way. Again, these are our five aggregates. This is the same dependent origination. We have our mind moment here, generating these. And then from that, we have feeling here, but really formations and perception influences that too. And this is all under the spell of ignorance, right? The punishment of our suffering. Craving leads to clinging, becoming a bird. And that is death. Aging and death, and then one will call it dukkha here. From dukkha, then, we go on to act unskillfully, you know, out of our suffering. We steal the Buddha there, or we say something harmful, or have a thought that's harmful for ourselves. And then that feeds into the next mind moment, and we get caught in this hamster wheel of misery and despair. Now, so what did the Abhidhammas do with this? They came up with 24 specific ways. Those arrows that have been throughout this whole thing, there's actually 24 types of arrows, you could say. These are different ways that events condition each other. I was going to say objects, but that A conditions B, sometimes the arrow is going two ways, sometimes they're influenced by other things, and these are all different forms of conditioning. Some of them make sense, like proximity, that means it's just conditions, whatever's closest to it. Predominance, whatever's the strongest factor conditions. There's a continuity or contiguity. Conascence means that events arise at the same time, they're born together, literally. Neutrality means A conditions B and B conditions A. And then there's different variations of that. I don't know what all these terms mean, but they are in the our book there if you wanted to read more. Pretty much everything I've talked about goes into more detail in that book. And the suttas don't really spell it out in this detail. They just talk about, they use some of it, they use these terms. Chayo means conditioning, and Hetu means root or cause. And those are the main two forms. And then, you know, these are all of these are other terms that will appear elsewhere. Like Indriya is sometimes faculty or power. We have karma, kama here. A lot of ati means presence or self, and this is an absence or not present. So the Abhidhamma really took these terms and thought of all the different permutations of relationship of events and came up with this. And so I mentioned this is all laid out in the Patthana, which is the seventh book of the Abhidhamma. And it's the biggest book, and it just goes, you know, through these different relationships ad nauseum. I'm not sure what slide is next. So, I'm gonna, so some of the conclusions, maybe I'll just kind of summarize and we'll have some time either for controversies or questions. Before we get to the take-home points, some of the conclusions that I may or may not have mentioned along the way. Each mind moment is a discrete moment, you know, and that exists in this flow of consciousness, the stream of consciousness that we have, and that by that model, you cannot have two mind moments occurring at the same time. Also, you can't have a wholesome and an unwholesome mind moment at the same time. So what happens is, let's say, you know, I want to steal this, and then this is very common with addictive behaviors. There's this pleasure inherent in it, but there's also a pain, you know, the junkie, for example, or the alcoholic who just keeps drinking. You know, they experience great pain and pleasure. That's not happening in the same moment. There's alternation between it. Or let's say we're doing something that we're, you know, but I don't know the term guilty pleasure, or, you know, there's something that we don't feel right about, but there's also some pleasure in it. And what's really happening is, like that one of those earlier slides, the red and the green are occurring simultaneously very rapidly, and we're going back from one to the other. This all happens very quickly, as we mentioned. According to the commentaries, millions of times, 17 million times in a flash of lightning. Probably neuroscience says it happens slower, you know, that the mind is very rapid, but, you know, maybe upwards of 50 times per second. By studying this and understanding it, we may have an ability to, I don't know, tease out different parts of it. So a lot of the discussion we've had today and the comments and the questions have been about recognizing, you know, different parts of the element, and seeing, oh, yeah, I recognize this mental factor, for example. When we went through the example of the boy stealing the apple, some of you made comments that, you know, suggested you grasped that, you know, we can grasp aspects of this, you know, without understanding this entire system. You know, it can be, you know, a useful roadmap, like looking at a map of the world. We may not know exactly where something is in France, but we can understand, you know, maybe on a more macroscopic level, you know, some aspect of the geography that can be helpful for our meditation practice. And I think one thing that's helpful I mean, this can get really heady, but one thing that's really helpful is to understand, again, those three characteristics, you know, that there's the permanence here, the dukkha, and then the not-self, so that we see, you know, because when I look at this table of factors, and if I try and imagine these factors in a particular mind state that I can be in that process, that kind of reflective process, which is more intellectual than intuitive, which is more, you know, maybe a reflection than rather than just being in a non-conceptual intuitive frame of mind, there can be a creation of the self in that. There can be, you know, a clinging to that. Oh, yeah, that's why when I'm angry, you know, I have these other different subtle qualities. So that that's just to say, you know, it's helpful with all this to know when to put the table down and meditate. And, you know, to understand it as a model or a map, and not the actual terrain, but, you know, not the actual territory. It's, you know, it's meant to be a guide. And these are our take-home points. Abhidhamma is both the theory, the meditation system that developed after the Buddha's death, and then this, you know, vast volume of literature and commentarial literature that developed around it. And this probably came out of a need to further codify, unify, expand upon the Buddhist teachings into a whole, and, you know, probably was used as a meditation model initially, and a lot of it now is intellectual, you know, and I think today we kind of dipped our toes into the water in an intellectual fashion. There was no guiding on the meditation. I mean, they kind of influence each other, but, you know, if we were really doing an Abhidhamma practice, you know, we'd probably be, well, we would have to renounce, you know, be, you know, totally dedicated to developing states of concentration, and then, you know, in some way working with these factors and dissecting our experience into each mind movement into these factors. That's kind of hard to do, I think. I can't do it, but that's probably where it came from. But we could use it as a map for understanding aspects of our meditative experience. And none of this is essential for freedom, for your awakening, or, you know, it's something that maybe is helpful, but certainly I don't buy the statement from some Abhidhammas that you need to know this to make it down the path. I hope that's something you take away from this optional framing. Now we have 15 minutes left for either discussion, or we can get into some of the controversies, or I don't know what. This has been a lot of material, and you've really been engaged in it, so perhaps maybe we can hear from anyone who would like to comment on what they think of this, or how it resonates or not.
Question. In order to determine the level of awakening, which is called jhana.
Now, there's two things. There's different levels of awakening, and then there's different levels of concentration. The jhanas, or also known as the meditative absorptions, those are levels of concentration which don't map one to one with awakening.
Okay.
It's a bridge or a tool.
Are these factors used to determine what level one is at?
In the jhanas? Or,
yes.
The way that is done is by looking, yes, the short answer is yes. There's what's called the jhana factors, all of which appear on our mental factors, I believe. Yeah. Actually, I don't see sukha, but most of them appear there. So there's a combination of mental factors that are called jhana factors, and so the meditation practitioner is supposed, you know, usually in concert with a teacher, is supposed to be able to understand what level of concentration, what jhana level they've reached based on what factors are present and what factors are absent.
Reading behaviors or feedback from the individual to help them determine that?
Well, it's more of a description of what happened, because the person, you know, I think most people in jhana are sedentary. They're sitting, you know, it's very high levels of concentration done in meditation practice. So usually the practitioner at that point, you know, this is not a beginner, this is someone who's been working with their mind. And what's essential for any of this is to really get these five hindrances tamed, you know, not permanently eradicated, but to know how to shape the mind in a way that they are totally absent. There's no hindrance whatsoever when you're in jhana. So if you can imagine that level of sophistication in working with your own mind, that, you know, that's a sense of how highly developed mentally one is when they are in these states. And so they would, after that experience, you know, if they had questions, talk about what your teaching said. This is what I saw present in my mind. There's a big controversy. There's this whole area called the jhana wars where, you know, people argue about various aspects. Are jhanas necessary for awakening? You know, are they important? Are they unnecessary? You know, this Vipassana insight meditation movement, kind of the mainstream belief, the way it's expressed here in this country, is that the jhanas are not necessary, and some would even probably argue that they're hindrance or that they're wrong practice. And that's not what the Buddha taught, and there's other teachers who will say just the opposite. They're indispensable, you have to do them. You know, this powwow that I mentioned, I think the system he teaches, he really says that, you know, it's an important part to master them on a very refined level. But I think, you know, whatever the truth of that is, how much concentration one needs, the more concentration, the better. And, you know, just from my own practice, I've noticed that the more calm and quiet my mind is, the more I'm able to see things, more insight naturally arises. And then, you know, the thing you mentioned about the jhanas, I just want to read something to you. The factors, this is, there's suttas that are, you know, very much like the precursors. So if you just look at the suttas and you just look at the Abhidhamma, you know, what's the missing link? And you can find certain suttas that list these details out in fine details. And one of them, kind of the main ones, is one Sariputta, that the Buddha was actually describing how Sariputta understood his mind in the jhana. So this was an example of a student who practiced jhana, and he then talked to his teacher, the Buddha, or actually in this sutta, the Buddha read his mind and knew where he was. I don't know if that happens in modern times, but he knew exactly what his mind was experiencing. This is Majjhima Nikaya 111. So once again, from the middle length, this course is Sutta 111, the Anapada Sutta. And he says, he entered and dwelled in the first jhana, and he determined individually the dhammas that were present in the first jhana. Thought, examination, those are the... also known as initial applications, in the 8 and 9, thought, examination, rapture, which would be PT number 12, pleasure, now that's sukha, I don't think sukha is on that list, 1 point to nisikagata, contact, feeling, perception, sound familiar, volition, and mind, which would be citta there, desire, resolution, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention. So these are, according to the sutta, all of the states of mind that are present in the first jhana. And that Sariputta saw these individual elements, you know, he's in this very concentrated state. And most people believe it's not when you're in the state that you cognize them, it's afterwards when you review them, you know, you see their dissolution. And then it goes on to say, those dhammas were known to him as they arose, known as they remained present, and known as they vanished. He understood these things come to be from a state of non-existence, and then having existed, they vanish again. So really looking at the states of rising and passing away in the mind, and you can just see in this, you know, how somebody could take all of that and really take other passages and feed it into that and come up with this amazing list, and that we see this rising and passing away of these states in the mind. So, and there's a number of suttas that, you know, definitely look like they are precursors to this sophisticated methodology of the Abhidhamma. We didn't get into it, but on this, the page with the mental factors and the material factors, material phenomena, if you look down there, there's this mental processes. And so this is another layer of complexity on top of everything else. So I've been describing each mind moment, but what this further this model, the Chittaviti, the mental processes, which is in the Abhidhamma, says that each one of those circles I drew up there actually consists of 17 mind moments, and here they are. So we have, but the Bhavanga is kind of thought to be the unconsciousness or the resting state of mind, or the dream state of mind where the mind kind of resides. And then there will be a sensory experience. So there will be past Bhavanga, then there's a vibrational, and then a rest Bhavanga. Then there's this five-door verdict. So one of the sense doors will advert or turn towards, you know, figuratively turn towards the sensory contact. Then there will be consciousness, the eye. In this case, we're talking about eye. It could be ear or any of the others. That eye consciousness receives that information. Then there's a moment of investigation, a moment of determination. And then there's these seven moments called the jhavanas, which is not jhanas, but the jhavanas, where we act upon it, the mind acts upon it, and that's where it produces the kama in those seven moments. And then there's these two final moments of registration of, you know, actually maybe understanding or comprehending or registering that. So this is, I didn't think it was complicated enough. And as I said in the beginning, the Abhidhamma looks at how 52 mental factors, 28 material factors combine to make 89 separate states of consciousness that can interact in 24 different ways, and each time there's 17 discrete subdivisions of the mind moment that occurs. Wow.
Can I ask a question? This one has been developed over the centuries, right?
Millennia, yes.
Millennia, right?
Well, actually, it was probably in this form of the Abhidhamma within 300 years after the Buddha's death.
So all these conclusions have been supported by modern science, so on, psychology or behavioral psychology?
Well, nobody's really
looked.
No, it's kind of hard to map it out. You know, it's interesting. So this is a subjective science, right? This is basically us turning inward with the mind and subjectively knowing our experience. And what science is trying to get at is an objective experience, this kind of universal third person, or, you know, kind of
examples.
Yeah, by, you know, they're not so much science, modern science is not so much interested in what, you know, your mind or my mind does, but what the human mind does. So it needs to study it from a certain perspective. And it's, you know, the whole scientific model is you develop a hypothesis and then you do experiments to try and disprove that hypothesis, and the more experiments you do that don't disprove it, the more likely the hypothesis is true. But very few things make it beyond the hypothesis level to what they're called laws. You know, we have, you know, the laws of thermodynamics, or the laws of gravity, Newton's laws of physics, for example. So they're kind of looking at the world from a different place. You know, meditatively, we're looking at things very subjectively. You know, it may be helpful to have an understanding of things on an objective level, or even have some idea of Western psychology can be helpful for a lot of meditators. I did a lot of therapy myself because I, you know, was stuck in my meditation and all this, you know, basically karma was coming up, dukkha, from past actions, and I needed, you know, help to deal with that that my meditation teachers couldn't provide, you know, Vipassana couldn't do. And I think a lot of modern practitioners, you know, use a combination of different modalities to help. But in terms of tracking these specific factors, there's probably some on here that some experiments have kind of touched upon, but it's sort of apples and oranges. It's kind of a hard to really approach it scientifically. You know, now we're mapping various areas of the brain that have certain functions. Like if somebody's in jhana, for example, what areas of the brain light up? And Lee Brazington, who's one of the teachers I mentioned earlier, who does teach the jhanas as an important part of practice, has been involved in some experiments where he's been in jhanas and they've you put them in a machine and, you know, kind of measures that. I think he's done EEG and functional MRI, and they've looked at what part of the brains are the brains lit up, and it's very different from normal consciousness, you know. So we're just beginning to really crudely map what happens in the mind, you know, in terms of a neuroscientific, neuroanatomical viewpoint. And, you know, probably then further down the line, once we understand this grossly in terms of this organ of the brain, there's what's happening on the subatomic level, what's happening energetically. You know, that's another frontier that's probably going to be a long ways away. What else? We're kind of stupefying it can be very heady, but it's, I guess on the positive side, the flip side is that I find that sometimes this can, by looking at this, then, you know, usually not in the moment, but sometimes later when I'm meditating, there will be some sort of opening up to, you know, an understanding of it. You know, just maybe it can be in a simple level of what's skillful and what's unskillful, or, you know, just that, you know, a certain mind state has these different flavors, you know, and can find that to be helpful sometimes. But never on the level of understanding all, you know, 52 factors or emotions. There's a great article on the resources, I think I have it on the handout, resources. The Real Practice of Mindfulness by Andrew Linsky. It's the last one you can get it online. And he talks about how this Abhidhamma system maps to what we do when we're doing mindfulness meditation. You know, what has to be present. And it's just, you know, it's well worth the read. And he talks about the different factors that are present in a moment of mindfulness and how it's both extraordinary. It's, you know, it's just a very special state of mind. But it's also not, you might get the sense, first blush, that how can I have this state of mindfulness that has a total of, 13 plus 19 universally ethical factors. But it's not that rarefied that, you know, that we all experience moments of mindfulness. You know, usually they're just one of those little blips on the radar screen. And what our practice does is make those blips more frequent and more likely to occur. And his article really, I think, you know, kind of talks about how that happens, how it's a very special state of mind, but it's also not an impossible or, you know, unfathomable state of mind. And mindfulness is not the goal of practice, right? The goal of practice really is wisdom, to gain insight into experience and then to let go of where we cling and crave and be free from the dukkha.
The way that you laid out that chart with the aggregates and how conditioning work, that was just awesome. It like really sort of clarified some things for me, so thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah.
One thing that's nice in terms of looking at how we perceive the world in this model is that when we look at this process, you can then actually start to see, or rather start to cultivate, this whole idea of not-self. Because if you look at each of those contact moments, you know, there's no I that's doing the contact. You know, contact happens, consciousness arises out of that, and then this whole thing progresses. And so it's really kind of interesting because when you break it down into, you know, 89 states and all of these different phenomena, that you can see that it's a phenomena-based process. And it's a process that does itself.
Yeah. Which has, you know, really huge implications in terms of free will and ownership of responsibility for one's actions, and, you know, who is making these decisions, and who picks up the tab at the end of the evening. It's very.
But you know, it's a process that can modify itself. So that's where wisdom comes in. Is the wisdom is the piece that allows modification of the process.
Yeah.
So the feedback loop.
Exactly.
And as wisdom grows, then that alters the conditions. So the conditions actually change as a part of the process.
Exactly. Yeah, I think I have, kind of in the back of all this, I have this slide that Andrew, I'm just going to show this for a minute, so I don't come back. But Andrew Linsky graphically right here, this is his framing of what we just went through, but Lori just said that, so we have this whole process going on of these five aggregates, and that in any given moment, you know, we consider it unskillful or skillful. We have unwise attention, so we get self-view, we're in the hindrances, and then we function out of these unwholesome roots, or alternatively, we could be without a view of self, but these factors of awakening based on these wholesome roots, and that there's this feedback that occurs to the next mind moment. Or alternatively, if we're in the unwholesome, that feedback, which we've been calling karma, occurs to feedback to create further suffering.
Are even these slides that you haven't used, are they going to be included in your...
I will, yeah. I mean, this is, I wouldn't call it copyrighted, but, and he doesn't circulate these. A lot of his material is available. He has a book out, and he writes them.
He's the one at the Joy...
The one at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies. Yeah, that's James Barris is the Awakening Joy, and this is Andrew Alinsky. And so this particular slide, I'll include it. Yeah, I usually cut it out because it's just extra stuff, but I thought I left it in the back of the presentation just because you might need to refer to it. And this is how you practice, is you develop the factors of awakening, and you prune away the hindrances. And whenever you recognize the view of self, you try and abandon it. Recognize it's an impulsive mind state.
So, just out of curiosity, when we have karma, if we have a thought in our mind that I'm experiencing this right now because of past unwholesome choices or whatever actions, I'm experiencing this is karma. Is it very unlikely that we recognize that in a moment, that this is in fact being years ago, I did this, and so today, what's going on? What's happening with me? What is this that's happening right now? Oh, you know what? This is probably karma from this past. Is it very unlikely that we have that experience where we really do recognize that this is very possibly karma from some past unwholesome choice?
What do you think? I mean, do you see the results of most of your actions?
Well, because so often results of actions are fairly on the heels of actions, not years down the road, and I'm not even going to touch another lifetime. That's unfathomable, right, you know, in this moment. So just in this lifetime, my experience is that choices, good or bad, usually quickly on the heels of those, you see the result of them fairly, you know,
within a reasonable time frame that you recognize this is, you know, this is the result of my good choices up until right here, right now. But poor choices from your youth or whatever, whether you recognize at the time that they were affecting you or not, they certainly probably were, but in ignorance, perhaps one isn't recognizing that. But then years down the road, I'm experiencing, and this is thoughts that are being generated through whatever, one little thing sparks a thought, perpetuates more thoughts about that, and it creates this discomfort in the body that's a felt sensation. And so why are then the thought arises, hey, what's going on? That was just a thought. Why did you take it to this level of, and then, well, maybe this is something you need to know and learn. And so I'm telling myself a story now around, I'm just wondering if I'm going more to Buddhist psychology than I am to just basic mindful practice. And that's what, you know, I just wonder if that's something that people have delved into and explored, whether or not a person can actually recognize in the moment that they've latched onto this so that they can know what this feels like. It's the result of a bad choice that they somehow avoided in the past. But now, for the purpose of learning, for the purpose of purification of the mind states, or, you know, I have this idea that the mind states, and this could be delusional, but I have this idea that the mind has to be go through a purification to know freedom and to experience wisdom and to know liberation and freedom, that there's got to be a purification. But if I've avoided painful through delusion or ignorance, if I've avoided painful things in the past, and now through this I'm kind of burning up, I'm just kind of like latching onto a little seedling of an idea and then perpetuating it until it creates this whole anxiety in my body and in my mind. I can feel it physically, the shaking, and then, which in turn perpetuates more thoughts about, oh, it's real, I feel it. And so that's all I'm saying is, I'm asking, is that if that's possible for us to recognize that that is karmic outcome.
Resultant. Yes and no. I think it's helpful to see causes and conditions when, you know, and the kind of key term here is proximate cause, to understand that that our actions have consequences and to see that, but also to really dwell in this and think a lot. This is one of the areas, one of the four areas the Buddha called the immeasurables, that he said if you really think too hard about the exact workings out of karma, your mind will unhinge. It should not be pondered, and if you do, he didn't say you go crazy, but, you know, basically it's not useful. Yeah, it's not useful to disconnect that. So that's one of the imponderables, is the exact working out of karma. I think it's just helpful to know that actions have consequences. On a meditative level, to see that, okay, when I say something harsh to my partner, my parent, whatever, this is what happens. And that, you know, just to kind of keep it really simple, when I have this fantasy of chewing out my boss, this is what happens in the body. You know, that kind of, especially if you can bring it into the body, you know, and get it out of the head, you know, to see that kind of cause and effect is definitely worthwhile to kind of work out. Well, because, you know, I hunted animals, for example, for me, because I hunted animals as a youth, that's why now I'm suffering this particular ailment or malady. And there's passages in the suttas where, you know, like the Buddha had a bad back, and there's several suttas where he would be giving a discourse and he would say, you know, to one Ananda or someone else, you know, my back's bothering me, I'm going to go lie down, you take over the rest of the Dharma talk. And the commentarial tradition said that was a result of something he did in a former life, and you know, that was his karmic result, was to have this, you know, as a Buddha, to have a bad back. And he died of dysentery, probably. And so that all of those have been interpreted as, you know, past life working out of karma. And I don't think that's helpful for us to think about that, or even earlier on in life, just to recognize, okay, I hunted animals, that, you know, was another time, that was another jet, another set of circumstances. I choose not to do that now, because I know it's not skillful for me. And this is what I choose to do. I choose to practice meditation, to meet in Sangha, to, you know, to do that. I think that's probably the best way to frame it.
And, you know, Steve Armstrong has often said, you can't unwind it, so why bother? I mean, because you don't know. You can't actually, it's not, there's no one-to-one mapping. Because there are other random factors that come in.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes something will happen. Maybe, you know, you're crossing the road and you get hit by a car and you go, oh, that must be because of bad karma. But that could be just a random thing because everything is conditioned. So to point back and say, I got hit by a car because of bad karma is actually incorrect. Because you can't know that. And there are random factors. So, you know, often people will say, I've got this cancer because I had bad karma. Well, that's not necessary. So you can't prove it. And so to dwell on that and to go, I'm experiencing this because I've done something bad in my past, is actually irrelevant.
You know, where the compassion piece comes in is to recognize we all suffer the same way, you know. If you believe in multiple lives or not, that we've all done skillful and unskillful things in our life, and that if you take this one person and this, you know, gets into our legal system and all that, who, you know, we look at as they've done maybe reprehensible actions, and to, you know, glom onto them all of our ire and, you know, punishments and retribution, you know, from this model does not make sense, you know, because we all are a product of our causes and conditions. And, you know, this gets at, you may be very Thich Nhat Hanh's poem, I'll Be By My True Names, where he, if you haven't read that one, it's very short, you can look it up, Thich Nhat Hanh, Call Me By My True Name, but he really gets at that, you know, we all have been perpetrators and victims, and that, you know, really the compassionate piece is to understand that it's our karma. Well, we're going to start cut off time. So thank you all for coming out and enduring such a marathon of thoughts. May you each be travel home safely and let this stuff drop away. It'll be there when you need it. And if you want to look it up, there's some references. But don't choke on it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.